Ken here. In nearly all of our podcasts, you hear students asking questions and their interaction with me. Many listeners find these exchanges illuminating because what is being asked is often exactly what is on their minds. If you find these conversations helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can maintain and expand our website. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, Buddhahood Without Meditation, Part 9.
It's okay. Stephen, I want to continue what I started last night. Last night I gave relatively high level description or pointers to how to concerning conduct, behavior in one's life. These are relatively traditional approach, and as is usually the case in traditional approaches, you get very high level principles and relatively little practical application. You have to figure all of that stuff out yourself. So this evening, I want to come down a little closer to earth. The first bit, something I think I mentioned yesterday or today, I can't remember. Oh, today. And that is the relationship between practice and life. Now, quite deeply embedded in the way Buddhism is presented is that you're not truly alive unless you're in retreat, and you're not doing anything really worthwhile unless you're meditating, practicing.
You're saying that's the traditional?
I don't want to even say it's traditional. I just want to say this attitude is very deeply embedded in the way Buddhism is presented. And there are reasons for that, and I don't really want to take time to go into some of them, but it goes back, and I think I was talking about this yesterday, to the very origins of Buddhism, which were it developed as a way of approaching life for people who were withdrawing from civil society. That's how it started. In the mid-90s, I was considering how to expand Unfettered Mind. And one of my students was a management consultant in Orange County, and I was discussing this with him. And I was describing a certain idea I had. And he just looked at me and said, "It'll never work." I said, "You don't know that much about Buddhism. How do you know it'll never work?" He said, "Ken," I said, "2,500-year history of disgruntled monks who don't get along with each other. It'll never work." And he's absolutely right. One of the very strong aspects of Buddhism is that it's about individuals finding their own way. And while large Buddhist institutions have formed and existed for many centuries, There have been relatively large numbers of people who pursued their own path, and in each generation they're usually regarded as black sheep, but then they turn out to have set the standard for the next generation, time and time again. And that's in all traditions of Buddhism. So, in a certain sense, it's a very... well, it's a way for the individual. Now, and I want to keep that in mind in what we talk about, because one of the things that always distressed me was the extent to which people would feel they had to lead two lives. There was their practice life and their regular life. And there was often always questions about the relationship between these two, and they had to take time from their regular life to lead their practice life. And it often created a great deal of internal tension in people, and quite often tension in families and so forth. And I never thought any of this was very productive. And the very vocabulary of Buddhism is biased in this direction. In Tibetan tradition, you have the words tun and tam. Tun means your formal meditation or formal practice period. And tam means in between. So you have your formal practice period and in between. Mm-hmm. Now, where's the emphasis here? In between refers to everything we normally call life. That's between practice sessions. So you already have the idea that somehow you're meant to squeeze your life in between practice sessions. This was probably okay in small monastic establishments, or as was the case when Buddhism first developed, where you had very small groups of monks who basically practiced on their own. They went and begged for food on their own, and then they would get together once or twice a month to renew their vows and provide a bit of support and checking up on each other. But it was all really individual stuff otherwise. So that way of approaching things, you had your formal practice period and in between, made sense, because most of your day, say three quarters of that, was formal practice periods. And there was stuff that went in between. But this approach, really makes you feel that you're a second-class citizen. Most of your time you're actually living, so to speak. And then you also have in Tibetan tradition the terms, which come from Sanskrit, I'm sure, Nyamjak and Jetop. Nyamjak refers to the composure, or equipoise, or however you want to put it, of formal practice, where you're sitting and you are resting in attention, doing some form of practice, rather. And very specifically refers to the experience that arises at those times. So that Nyamjak we call composure, or usually translated as something like that. And then Jetop, or Jeshe, is called ensuing attainment, or ensuing understanding. It's what you carry from that experience of formal practice. And again, you can see how the bias is in one way. Then you have this term in Tibetan called lamcher. I don't know the Sanskrit for it. I find it an extremely difficult term to translate. Literally, it means to carry on the path. And the idea here is, how do you carry your experience of composure or formal practice in between periods and keep it going? And again, you can detect the bias that you're only really alive when you're in formal practice. I think all of these thoughts and attitudes are problematic in the circumstances in which all of us live and practice. So, the way that I prefer to approach this now is there is only one practice, and it's the practice of attention, the cultivation and stabilization of attention. And if you want to get really fancy about it, as a friend of mine does, there is the cultivation and stabilization of attention, and which leads to the stabilization of awareness, which leads to the stabilization of presence. And you can sort the practices as to where they work in that. But when you look at this, that way of looking at it, stabilization of attention, awareness, and presence, then that's what practice consists of. And you have two kinds of practice. Practice in which you're not engaged in any other activity, and practice where you are engaged in activity. And both are equally important. There's a Burmese teacher in Northern California who for many years taught only practiced engaged in activity. She had her people do absolutely no sitting meditation. They would come to her place and for a retreat, and they would be given tasks to do, and along with the tasks there would be a question such as, as you're doing this task, what is your experience of like, dislike, and neutral, like, dislike, or indifferent? And when you met with her for an interview, you got grilled. Okay, so you're cleaning the toilet. Which parts did you like? Which parts did you not like? And so all the time you're engaged in these tasks, you were to be bringing attention to what you are actually experiencing. It was very effective. But over time you came to appreciate that the sitting practice allowed, that is practice unmixed with attention, allowed another level of attention to develop, which reinforced that practice. And that's why they're both important, because practice unmixed with attention is where you develop, gives you the optimal conditions to develop stability. But there are so many people who are really good on when they're sitting on the cushion, and when they get up, they're complete jerks. Because there is no understanding or comprehension of actually bringing that quality of attention into day-to-day life and interaction. So they'd be very, very good sitting, and then they're completely reactive in their ordinary life. And this is not just lay people. We see this actually to a disturbing extent in many Buddhist institutions, monasteries, so forth. So what that's led many people to consider is, okay, how do I integrate my practice into my life? And that sounds like a perfectly reasonable question. How do I take my practice into my life? But when you consider that question, there's still a bias towards practice implicit in it. That's a small problem. The large problem is it doesn't work. It absolutely doesn't work. Because what people do with this is they generate a stable attention. They may have experiences of clarity, insight, peace, calm, all that good stuff. And they try and take that to their lives. In doing so, they're contradicting the basic principle of practice. When you are sitting in meditation, in formal practice, and something comes up in your practice, like some kind of emotion, what do you do in practice, formal practice? What have you been doing for the last 10 days? Please say something, otherwise I'll be trying to
Must be.
I need a little more than that, Alicia. Okay. And in experiencing it, what happens? Well, we aren't finished yet. I told you there would be tests. In experiencing it, what happens?
It dissolves. Or may dissolve.
Okay. But you experience it. You don't bring peace and clarity to it, do you? I said peace and clarity, not peace of clarity. This is not pie we're talking about. Okay, and when you experience it, you say it dissolves. Another way of saying that is you find peace and clarity in the experience.
Eventually, sometimes, after great effort.
Well, of course. That's why you practice. You know, it depends on the volatility of the issue. And about a year and a half ago, some stuff came up, and it took me about 30 days to find peace and clarity in the experience. That was interesting. Daily meditation. Every meditation was quite interesting. So, and that's what we do in practice. We open to the experience, and this is, doesn't matter whether you're doing mindfulness or primary practice or even yidam practice, or anything. It's what you do. So in this wording, I'm going to take my practice and integrate it into my life. You're going to take this good experience you have and bring it to your life. Well, there's an old saying among military strategists. The best battle plans last until first contact with the enemy. Because, one second, Carolyn. In almost all battle situations, you have your plan, the enemy has their plan, you launch your plan, and the enemy does something different. And from then on, it's improvisation. Carolyn?
Well, are you saying that people want to bring the result into their life? Because I don't understand why you wouldn't just, during the day, have moments of just being open and paying attention.
Okay.
Is that
I think you put it very well. What people generally try to do is to bring the results of their practice into their life.
But I find it strange to hear that people can practice very well on the cushion and then leave the cushion and be completely different.
Well, this is because you've been subjected to a horrible form of training which doesn't take that approach. So that doesn't make any sense to you. But the majority of training is like that. And it's people.
Then what are they doing?
What are they doing in their practice?
Yeah.
Oh, they're pushing, and they're pushing hard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In many cases. But, and then they try to remember what to do in the rest of their lives. And, of course, how many of you have found that trying to remember to be mindful and effective? Anybody found this, remembering to be mindful? You know, it's already too late. Yeah. by a minimum of 500 milliseconds, it's all gone. So, and people have asked me time and time again, how do I integrate my practice into my life? How do I integrate my practice into my life? And I say, well, do this. And it never works. Because they simply don't remember. And the thing is, you can't remember. I mean, when you're practicing and a thought has grabbed your attention, how effective is remembering to be mindful? Well, let's not quibble. Is it possible to remember to be mindful? No, it's not. So this is completely, I don't like to play it anything black and white or anything like that. I don't have very strong opinions about this. So, this is utterly and completely the wrong approach. The question is, how do I bring my life into my practice? That's get you to look at things differently. The practice is about attention. So when you say, how do I bring my life into my practice? It means, how do I start approaching my life in attention? What?
That turnaround, bringing life into your practice, I have this memory with both my sons of trying to do prostrations and them as toddlers coming and inserting themselves between me and the ground just as they start to that was my life going into my practice.
Yeah, exactly. Whoops, don't want to crush you, dear.
But they were welcome.
It was
fun.
Yeah. So... So what this leads to, of course, is the practice of attention mixed with activity. Now, you want the bad news about this? There isn't any good news.
Being optimistic.
There is a direct corollary of this that nobody really wants to acknowledge. Once you take this approach, there are no vacations. Any vacation is self-indulgence.
Is what?
Self-indulgence.
Oh, okay. I thought you said something else.
What did you think I said?
Never mind.
No, I'm curious. It's okay. So And that's very important. There are no vacations. Everything you, every aspect of your life is a place where you exercise attention. And it includes such mundane things as changing diapers, cooking, you know, driving to work, making love, you know, everything. Now, it gets worse. Because when you start doing this, really practicing attention in all these activities, you begin to see at a whole nother level what proportion of your life is driven completely by reactive patterns. And it's just bounce, 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 bounce from one reactive pattern to another.
Isn't it like that in meditation too?
At the beginning, yes. And at the beginning of this practice, it's the same. Definitely. In meditation, we call that, and that is officially the first stage of meditation. It's when you see it's just bounce, bounce, bounce. I mean, I love the quotation from Gunaratna in Mindfulness in Plain English. I won't get it exactly right, but it says, at some point in this process, you'll come to the conclusion that you are completely crazy. Your mind is a mad, gibbering madhouse, running pell-mell down the hill, utterly out of control. No problem. You aren't any crazier than you were yesterday. You just know it now. And this is when we start experiencing our life and attention. This is what we find out. None of it makes any sense. It's just a mess. So that's the first stage. And it has all kinds of highly technical names, such as a recognizing monkey mind. That's the official name. Or, mountain stream bouncing over rocks, first stage of meditation. And so it's exactly the same in what I'm suggesting here. Now, we do exactly the same thing in this life practice as we do in formal practice. That is, whenever we note we are distracted, which in the beginning will be, those moments will be few and far between. We do exactly what you were saying a few moments ago, Carolyn. You just drop back into attention. In the way that most of you know that I teach basic meditation, the principle is return to what is already there. You've heard me say this any number of times. So you do the same thing in this practice of life. Oh, I don't know why I was saying that. And you just return to what's already there. What's already there is your body. And so you keep coming back to that. And after a while you can come back to the body and feelings and so forth. And it's just exactly the same. But you're doing this practice. And many people find it very helpful to because the habituation of reactivity is so deep and the associations that trigger reactivity are so present in our lives to build in some reminders. One of my students, many years ago, down in Orange County, gave him the very simple thing, you know, always take a breath whenever you open the door. It's like a reminder. And I used to stay overnight at his place because I had an office in Orange County. And the next time I went down, he had green post-its on every door in his house. That's not just the doors from one room to another, every cupboard door. Because he realized after a couple of days he just wasn't remembering it at all. So he had all these green post-its. Open the door, take a breath. And very simple practice and very effective. And you can make up these. And what you're doing here is building in interrupters in your life, interrupting the continuous operation of habitual patterns or reactive patterns. So you start dropping into attention consistently in your life. And something begins to change in exactly the same way that something begins to change when we do this in formal meditation practice. And, you know, there are hundreds of these. Thich Nhat Hanh's very good at this stuff. There's the telephone meditation. I always answer the telephone on the third ring. You know, the way he does it, he builds off one of his gathas or verses. Phone rings the first time, you go, come. Sit there, wait for the second ring, and then you say, smile. Then you wait for the third ring and you say, present. You pick it up. Now, what's the chances of the conversation going better if you're calm, smiling, and present, as opposed to, hello? I have completely failed at this with one of my HBO clients. Because whenever she does answer the phone, it's always on the first ring, and it is, yes! I have a very good friend in Los Angeles who's a very good friend and a very bad student. And she started off a student. She's proved to be a hopeless student, but she's been an extremely good friend over the years. When she calls you, you pick up, hello, and she never identifies herself. She just starts straight into the conversation. Like, hello? I was thinking that we should get together. She just assumes you know who this is. Very disconcerting. I've made zero progress on that one, too. So, this kind of basic level stuff. And the next level I want to move to is primary practice. There is... I'll be broad-minded about this. There's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't be doing primary practice all the time. That's sufficiently broad-minded. It's, we're sitting here right now. You can experience the whole room and everything in it and the sound of my voice all at the same time. That's quite possible. How many of you were doing it? So, but that's what I mean about making life practice. And that's certain practical benefits. friend of mine was talking on the phone. He said, I'm really glad I was doing that opening to all experience thing. I was laid down on my bed and I caught a black widow spider in the corner of my eye. Out of just so you tend to notice a lot more. It's very, very good to do at meetings. Because when you do it at meetings, you will stay in touch with what is actually happening in the room. And that'll just happen. And you will feel the flow of energy and feelings. Often you may not be able to put it into words, but you go, oh, okay, I can't do that right now. So forth. But it's not how most people are working in meetings. Very good negotiators actually do that. That's why they're good negotiators. You can do it while driving. I would limit it to opening to all sensory experience while driving. That can be very beneficial. And just be a little careful about this. I was doing this one day while it was raining, as I was driving on the 210 freeway, and I kept getting entranced by the pattern of rain, of raindrops on the windshield, and I keep coming back to everything. So, be a little careful about it until you get there. But obviously, if you have that kind of open awareness, so you are aware of where every car is around you, that's going to help you when you're driving. You'll be aware of things that are happening on the side of the road while your attention is on what's happening in front of you. How many of you have seen that basketball thing? You know what I'm talking about.
The thing simulated?
Where they're throwing basketballs.
Yeah.
It's on the net. Yeah, it's on YouTube, yeah. I'm pretty sure. British Transportation Authority made a commercial out of this, which they use to point out how difficult it is to see a cyclist at night when you're driving, because your attention just isn't on the shape or the movement or patterns associated with a cyclist. So your attention's on driving. What happens in this thing? You have it here? Pardon?
We have an internet.
Yeah, we do. Well, we can do it afterwards. But the
probably shouldn't say much more.
Okay, so you want to set it up? No, not now. Okay. I don't want to interrupt this, but okay, Art will show this to you afterwards. And I showed it to Franca, I think. She said,
no, we showed it
to you.
The original Harvard one.
Yeah, that's right. And anyway, we won't go into it. Afterwards, later, tomorrow, whatever. Attention can be highly selective. So practicing broad attention, inclusive attention in life is, it's not only is it your practice, but it also makes a very significant difference to how things actually unfold in your life. If you're having a conversation with someone and you open to the whole experience of that conversation, including the room that you're in and everything that is arising in you, you'll be far more aware of when something the person says triggers a reaction in you. You'll pick it up so much earlier. And and start working with it so much earlier. that the whole course of the conversation will change. And over time you'll become very sensitive to nuances in body language, in tone of speech, and where what they're saying and the emotional energy that's behind it either match or don't match, all of that stuff. And this leads into the third, if you're keeping count, I'm not, so I don't know what's third, fourth, or whatever, but it feels like three to me, thing that I want to talk about. If you approach your life with this kind of open awareness, it means in everything you do, you're including your whole life. Now, there's a very strong encouragement in our society to compartmentalize. We're at work, you do work stuff. Home, you do home stuff. Social life, you do social life stuff. And, you know, never, these things aren't meant to meet. And the result, not infrequently, are very significant imbalances in our lives. And more problematic is we actually develop different personalities and identities. So people can be extremely present and competent and very easy to get along with in the work environment, and total maniacs at home, or sometimes they're very good with their families and complete maniacs in the office. And there's, what's going on here? If you, you know, a work decision comes up, and let's say it's a fairly significant one, open to your whole life, because that work decision is going to have implications elsewhere in your life, in all likelihood. My old office partner was an executive search person, headhunter, and every now and then, he's very good at his work and quite thorough in vetting candidates and making sure they really wanted this job and they were a good fit for the organization. And this was usually at the C level. So he's working with very high level executives. And but on one occasion, he had successfully negotiated a deal with this executive from the East Coast to become, I think, the CFO or something, may have been the CEO, of a gambling company in Los Angeles, Las Vegas. And you know, the salary, the bonuses, stock options, all the stuff had been negotiated, moving along, you know, all the usual stuff. And 2 days before the deal was to close, he got a phone call from the executive saying, I can't do this. And this has happened to my brother, my office partner before, so he didn't lose his temper, says his phone. Okay. Because he's out a couple of $100,000 on this one. And he says, what's going on? Well, I was having breakfast with my family. And my 12-year-old son said, Dad, I don't want you to run a gambling company. And that was it. So, in all of the months that had gone, he had not included his whole life. And presented the news to his family, and his son said, you know, I'll feel good about it. And, you know, every father wants to be an inspiration to their son. So, that was it. So, my purpose in bringing this up is that including your whole life, whenever you're confronted with any kind of major decision in any area of your life, is very important. You have stuff coming up in your family, include your work life, so forth. And in this way, there will actually be some relationship. One other example. The woman I coached at HBO, and when I first started coaching her, I said, okay, if there's one thing you want to change about your life, your work life, what would it be? It's part of goal setting. What you do in the coaching world if you don't do it in the Dharma world. And she said, I want some more time with my family. And she had 4-year-old twins. So I said, what time do you leave work? 7:30. It's entertainment industry. They start at 10, but they go to 7:30. I said, okay, that's easy. She said, why? You have a hard leave at 6. And she just goes straight into shock in front of me. I can't do that. I said, sure you can. There aren't any guards with machine guns posted at the doors. Just walk out at 6. And they said, well, I can't do that. People give me work at 5:30. I have to get it done before I leave. I said, yeah, that'll continue for a week. But after you keep leaving at 6... then they'll give you that work at 4:30. You'll get it done before you leave. So I went to see her the next week. I said, how'd it go? She said, well, the first day was a little scary. I literally tiptoed out of the office to see if anybody was watching me leave. But nobody said anything. And I had a nice evening with my family. So I did it again the next night. And later she said it was the single, in all our coaching, it was the single thing that made the biggest difference in her life. And it was exactly as I said, within a week or two, everybody else had got used to it, reorganized the work, so she got all her work done, and she got to spend time with her family. So this kind of compartmentalization is very, very problematic, because it means that when we're in one world, we are completely ignoring the other. And that's how the imbalances arise. So people would say, like, I can't possibly do this. But actually, it's simply a matter of doing it, and you find that you can. Now, I want to go a little further with this opening thing. One of the perspectives we've been working with is that life is what you experience. What you experience is your mind. And if you now apply the transitive law of mathematics, you get your life is your mind. And then you can do, what's it, the reciprocal law, your mind is your life. This is actually very important. Translate this into ordinary terms. It means your life consists of only what you experience. Not more and not less. The only thing you can know is what you experience. In particular, you cannot know anything about anybody else. Because what is your experience of another person? Art?
Projection.
No, your experience of another. What is your experience? What is it? Let me ask the question a slightly different way. What is another person in your experience? Dan?
The experience of their bring up in you.
I think we can be a little less convoluted than that. Donna?
They're part of your experience.
Yeah, but let's get down to basics.
How you feel about them, what you think about them, is projection.
No. Your experience of another person are sights, sounds, sensations, and on top of that, all of the emotions that you associate with those and all the stories you associate with that. Okay? That's your experience of another person. You don't know anything about the other person. You have, if you want, in psychological terms or neuro terms, you have this representation of the other person. That's what you're relating to. How many of you experienced relating to the representation and it not quite fitting with the other person? And what have the results of that been?
Interesting.
Okay. I usually have a graphic to accompany this, but so you just have to imagine this. Draw a circle. Doesn't have to be a big circle, okay? That's your world of experience. Okay. Draw another circle which just touches that circle. That's the other person. That's their world of experience. There is a point of contact which you can label as point of contact. That point of contact is in your world of experience. And everything else is in your world of experience. That's all you actually know of the other person, is that point of contact. Everything else, as several of you just pointed out, is projection.
I don't understand. When you say the point of contact is the only thing you can know of the other person, how can you know even that much?
Oh, because you have these sights and sounds, that's the point of contact. There, you hear the sound of their voice.
So your experience is the point of contact.
You experience the point of contact, yes.
I'm getting hung up on that.
Okay. I'll do a demonstration with Larry in a minute. Now, if you take the attitude that the other person is a black box, that is, you cannot know what's inside, then you only have your experience. And you apply what we've been talking about in the course of this retreat. You open to that experience. What do you find in that field of experience when you do that? Anybody? varies. When you're open to the field of experience, what do you find in that field of experience?
Sights, sounds.
Yeah, all of that. Keep going.
Association stories, projections, thoughts.
Yes, okay. And you're opening to all of that? I'm getting worried.
The stage in which that occurs. The frame.
What do you find in that? Okay, how many of you have done any skygazing? Okay. So there you're looking at the sky. What do you find in your experience of looking at the sky?
Nothing.
And in addition to nothing.
There's lots of stuff
out
there.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about all
the big
It's fascinating. It's just fascinating.
So nothing. Your mind is.
What is aware of the projections? What is aware of nothing? Pardon? You find knowing, don't you? It's the sky's fault.
Yeah, it was only one day.
Okay. That when you open to experience, you find knowing. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now
we have a point of contact.
Yeah, what he said.
I think we have to stay here for another 10 days. Start this all over again. I can stay. How many of you can? So, you find a no. Now, there are various fancy Buddhist terms for this knowing, like vipa and pristine or timeless awareness, or, you know, all of this stuff. But there it is. Now, a lot of people miss this knowing because it is not conceptual. It is immediate and direct. And it's very interesting. People are scared out of their minds to live their life on the basis of that knowing. I was giving a guest lecture at Claremont on my friend Jeremy's class, business school, in which after he's trained them for about 7 or 8 weeks in various forms of mindfulness practice, he asked me to come in and talk about mindfulness and attention and conflict and relationship. And I usually do this in the form of, or at least part of the class, it's in the form of role plays. And in one of these classes, these are all people who have businesses and have jobs. This is part of the MBA program. One person was describing a difficult situation. His father had died, and he found himself in partnership with his father's partner in the business. So here he was in his late 20s, early 30s somewhere, and he's in partnership with a 55 or 60 year old man. A little difficult situation, who has his ideas about what he wants to do with the company, mainly take as much out for his retirement as he can, and now he's got this young guy who wants to grow the business, so it's a difficult situation. So we entered into a role play with one person playing the partner and him playing himself. And there's a particular exercise I do with this which involves asking questions, but in order to know what question to ask, you have to be right in touch with your own experience. You can't figure it out conceptually. So we hit this point in the role play, and he asked the question, and it didn't work because he wasn't in touch with his experience. So I guided him to be in touch with his experience, and the right question just popped out like that. And then he went, "What the hell happened?" And he was just like, because it was the first time he'd experienced doing something without thinking. Now, this is how the direction in which you are moving towards living your life. Yes?
This is a big question. Because doing something without thinking can also mean, you use the example of that translation of the Iliad.
It just felt so right.
And that, I mean, how do you tell the difference between those two experiences? And I don't know how many people remember this.
How do you receive the results?
It's the only way.
Sorry?
It's the only way. Let me come back to your question. Okay? So, in this, when you open this way, bit by bit, you will have the opportunity and you are, for direct knowing. Then you have to learn to act on that direct knowing. All right, can we do a little push now?
Just a sense of kind.
Okay. So, this is a Tai Chi exercise. Now, we just have this one point of contact where we're holding a butterfly. We don't want to crush the butterfly, and we don't want to let it go either. And so, typically, it looks like this. You just move around, and you can go anywhere you want. See, he's trying to push me over.
Why did you ask me all those hard questions?
Okay, now. We're going to do this
exercise. I'm a little worried about the butterfly.
Butterfly's fine. Okay. Okay. Now we're going to do this a different way. Larry and I are going to think about what the other person is doing. And we're going to try to anticipate what the other person is doing. Okay?
Butterfly gone.
Actually, we've been quite careful. We haven't crushed the butterfly. But, you know, but what's happening? Okay. Okay, now... Now, I'm not going to think about it. You can do whatever you want, Mark. I'm not going to think about what he's doing. Go ahead. So what happens?
You're less engaged.
Are we less engaged?
No.
We're able to be responsive.
Yeah. I mean, then talking to you, I'm not even thinking about what he's doing. He's still haven't pushed me out. Okay? Thank you. You open and you experience the point of contact in your whole world. And there's a knowing there. But if you collapse down, then everything stops. And that's most of our lives, that's what we're doing. We're collapsing down and doing this. But if you just forget about trying to know what is going on in the other person and trying to figure out what's going on in the other person, and you open to your own experience, then you get this movement back and forth, which I think you have to admit was a little more interesting than us sitting there like this. Now, there is one small problem with this. Just a very small problem. Do I get to control what Larry does? Does Larry get to control what I do? Does anybody have a problem with this? That's the problem.
You weren't controlling before either, when you were trying to figure
out. Absolutely, we were, weren't we?
anywhere.
We aren't going anywhere, and we weren't going to go anywhere because you're trying to control everything.
But you still didn't have control.
No, you don't have control. Control is an illusion. But trying to control is what stops everything.
Trying to control is an illusion.
Okay? So, to actually live one's life this way is a practice. And we get to Frank's question now, which is, how do I avoid making mistakes? Right?
It's more than that.
Well, how do I avoid doing things out of reactive emotions?
Well, you know, that particular image describes a very particular kind of experience. This is not just your day-to-day reactivity. This is when, you know, some great gust comes up and it just feels, as the line said, it feels so right to do this. I just know what the right thing to do is.
Okay.
And when dust settles, you see that it was not the right thing to do at all, but it felt exactly like the right thing to do.
So you have
it wasn't a thinking thing or anything.
Yeah,
like that.
Exactly. You have the four steps of standing up. You know these.
Oh, right. Tell me anyway.
Show up. That is, you enter the experience of the situation. You don't try to manipulate it from afar. You open to what is happening. Which means you don't shut down to anything. In that opening, you find a knowing. You serve what is true to the limit of your perception. You never have complete information. Let me say that again. You never have complete information. This is two applications. You never have complete information about what is happening outside of you. You never have complete information about what is happening inside of you.
What was three again?
You serve what is true to the limit of your perception.
That's four.
That's three.
About three was you find knowing.
No, that's part of three. Three is you serve what is true to the limit of perception. You don't serve yourself, you don't serve the other person, you serve the whole. And that is an action. Serving is an action. You do something. And for those of you who are legalistically inclined, because I have to include this, not doing something is doing something.
What
that did this. Four is you receive the result.
I'm sorry.
You receive the result. Now. Pardon?
You don't get to skip that one.
You don't get to skip that one. Now, there are basically two things that can happen here. If you have seen clearly, then what you do works. It serves what is true. If, however, you have not been able to see clearly, either because of some lack of information about what's happening outside, or because you aren't able to be in touch with yourself inside, then the situation may blow up. And when it does, you will get to see what you couldn't see before. and you receive that result. Go on. There is no guarantee in life that everything's going to work out.
This is an ongoing process.
Exactly, Eugene. Because as soon as you receive results, now you show up. Exactly, you show up in the next situation. You know, and it's the mess. You show up in the mess. And this happened to me very badly in a consulting job where I was had advised a certain strategy, and it crashed and crashed badly, and really hurt my main client in the process, which is not a thing you want to do. But she was very good about it. She said, okay, we're in this situation. What do we do now, Ken? And so we actually were able to use that crash to be able to demonstrate that there were two non-communicative cultures in the organization. It wasn't the best result. It would have been better to have done something else, but we were able to use that, and that gave us leverage for a whole bunch of other stuff. But it took very, very long time to get over the problems that that crash caused. So things happen, but you take what you got, and now you work with that. And you never can tell how things are going to work out. Carolyn.
Can you, I asked you once before if you could sort of define intuition in relation to all this. Can you do that again?
Geez, what did I say? I haven't got a clue.
Because that's, you know, that can be a powerful, it can be something that you can go with quite powerfully.
Well, intuition is a form of knowing. It can be, first off, intuition is a very vague word in English. Now, what it actually is referring to is not clear at all. But we can look at it as a form of knowing. Sometimes it comes from a body sense of things. You know, you come into a situation and your body says, this is really not a good place to be, then everything looks just fine. And your body is picking up stuff. How many of you have had that experience? Yeah, we've all had that experience. So, in some cases, intuition simply means trusting your body, what your body's telling you, which many people pay zero attention to and can't even detect. There's also an emotional intelligence, an emotional mind that operates. So everything can sound very nice, but it just doesn't feel good or feel right. Or conversely, everything can sound horrible, but somehow we know this is the direction we need to go. What I suggest here is not simply relying on intuition, but opening to the totality of your experience and resting in that until you find clarity.
So intuition isn't a total experience?
I don't think it is necessarily a total experience.
But it's not rational either, it's not conceptual?
It's not conceptual, yeah. Dan?
This knowing, traditionally, it's taken specialized environments, and such as the one we've had this week, to come in contact with that. Now, to bring that to life, do you recommend the first type of attention, then moving on to this?
What do you mean by the first type?
Well, you're talking about bringing attention to everything you do. That's somewhat different, isn't it?
Not really, because as I pick up this book, I can be aware of everything around me.
Okay.
I mean, first is just bringing attention to do, but then you work with the openness. And this is straight application of the principles of mindfulness and awareness from shamatha practice.
Mm-hmm.
Being present with the object of attention and then aware of everything. And actually practicing that, making that how we actually live. So that all the time you are aware of everything around you. So you are aware of where people are in the kitchen, so you don't bump into them. So, to me, there's just the one practice of attention.
Okay, so it's just the...
Yes.
I mean, when I've done Gantra applied, I find that the more... I started some time ago combining my morning practice and my sitting practice and going outside and walking.
Mm-hmm.
As a kind of a transition to the day.
Okay.
And I found, and I also use it in driving,
mm-hmm.
where it works quite well. Until I turn on the radio.
Yes.
Yeah.
So.
And then it doesn't work so well. And also in an office, in a closed in space where there's a lot happening. Very, this practice I found is very difficult.
I didn't say it was easy. And it's more difficult in certain environments
mm-hmm.
than others, no question. But that's how you're living your life. Bring that life into your practice. Now, the alternative is you create the ideal conditions, which is what yogins and people do. But that's not what any of us are doing.
No, we're not.
We've chosen to live this way.
Yes, we are.
And in doing so, we have actually chosen how we're going to practice. And in doing so, we have chosen how we are going to practice.
Mm-hmm.
That's our practice environment. That's it. Don't change your life. Practice it. You know, so there you are, you know, just open to everything. It'll be a little confusing at first. But you may be surprised what happens.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's, and you bring in another point. A lot of people want to create the ideal conditions for practice. And, you know, if our life is our practice, bringing our life into our practice, that translates into creating the ideal conditions for our life. Now, I've met a couple of people who do that. And, they were giving two women, they gave two different presentations on how to approach life so that it worked for you. I really didn't like either of their presentations because it was all about how do you exploit the world to create the life that you want. And it always involves preying on other people's greed and fear for your own profit. Which, you know, just rubs me the wrong way ethically. So, this, we have our life. Bring that life into practice. That may lead to it changing something, but bring the life that you have now into your practice. Okay, so I've discussed about opening. And this is a direct application of what we've been doing in this retreat. You open to the whole, and there's that knowing. And, I mean, what makes it very difficult here is that you'll end up doing things which, you know, have nothing to do with your self-image or who you think you are, etc., etc. Some people find that difficult. Marsha?
Well, the question of bringing your life into your practice, well, would you approach that the same way you might like approach like a hot potato in your like a reactive motion? Would you like do it in like titrated at first? Well, say for instance, I'm a school teacher, which I am, and I see 125 to 150 kids a day. And, you know, it's just like organized chaos, slightly.
And not so organized.
And not so organized sometimes. So to be completely aware all the time, and that's a huge bill of goods to try to.
Yeah, so you're going to develop ability to do it, so you pick places to start and work from there. And they'll bleed into each other. So yeah, on a practical basis, start working with something you can do, build ability, and then you can do more. You know, and you look at what I call this is finding suitable practice fields. Now, there's one more topic I want to touch on, which I've mentioned to many of you in the interviews. And that is, there are many different terms you could call this, but it's a way of working with reactive patterns.
Can you repeat that?
It is a way of working with reactive patterns. But this is a fairly broad principle. A little background. Every reactive pattern, I think it can be argued, developed at some point in our lives as a survival strategy. When we encountered a situation, and it may have been a one-time situation or it may have been an ongoing situation, I'm just lumping those together right now, which we could not experience completely. When that happens, we always split in two, or two parts develop. I call these the expressive and the receptive. One could also call them the active and passive. Receptive. So typical pairings, bully, coward. Bully is the expressive, coward is the receptive. The tyrant, helpless pair. You know, one is total control and the other is, I can't do anything. That split always occurs. Both are present in us, but we usually identify with one. And only flip to the other when we are pushed to the wall. So, a bully coward is an easy one. If you meet and challenge a bully, they become a coward. And conversely, when you corner a coward, they become a bully. And you can do it with any of the other pairs. It works the same way. So, usually we identify a reactive pattern by identifying one pole, the pole that's actually working. So, maybe whenever we encounter conflict, we feel sad. Other people, whenever they encounter conflict, they get angry. But we feel sad. That's the receptive pole. The other people who encounter conflict, they get angry, energized. That's the expressive pole. Whenever you identify a pole of a reactive pattern, include the other pole in your awareness. It may take you a little while to get in touch with the other pole, but it's always there. when you include oath, the effect of that, there are a couple of effects. One is you can't escape into an extreme position. So it keeps you in the experience. I'm assuming you want to be there. At least that's your intention. The other thing it does, or the second thing it does, is it allows you to find the appropriate balance in the situation. And that's always, the appropriate balance is always something that moves moment to moment. But by including both poles, you don't get locked into one side, and so you can actually be constantly correcting the imbalances and moving wherever you need to move. That's made possible because when you include both poles, and this is the third thing, it opens up the spectrum between the poles. Ordinarily, when we're locked in a pattern, it's either this or that, and we lose any touch with, no, there are all of these gradations, these shades of gray. When you include both poles, all of the stuff in between becomes accessible. And so your responses to situations be far more precise and nuanced. Now, this is not a conceptual process, even though I'm describing it. All you have to do, I mean, in exactly the same way, I think it was last night I was saying, attention on this crown of your head and the soles of your feet. And as soon as you do that, you become aware of your whole body and everything in it. It just, you know, you don't, your attention doesn't stay there and there. It's everything in between. You know what I mean? So, you've encountered a situation where, you know, you're really sad about it, but it's also a boundary violation. So part of you is angry. So now you include that anger. And now you experience the situation in a very, very different way. You're stepping out of being locked into one side of the pattern. And so this raises the level of attention so that you are actually out of the pattern and can see the spectrum and can operate and respond to the situation from a higher level of attention. So these are, I hope, things you can actually use to bring your life into your practice. You start living this way, situation by situation. One of the things that comes out of this is that because of the higher level of attention, because of the inclusive attention where you're including everything, you will see and know things that other people don't. And so you will act in a way which just seems totally straightforward. In fact, it seems like the only thing to do. And other people say, how did you know how to do that? But it's simply because you were including more. And the more you include, the less choice you have. And I like to say that the illusion of choice is an indication of the lack of freedom. When you see things really, really clearly, there's usually only one course of action open. All of those of you who are in various professions know this to be true. When you have a high degree of expertise and awareness of a situation, you see that what a lot of things that other people consider viable options are simply not viable. And the range of viable options, when you consider everything, comes down to very, very few. Okay. I think that's about it. Is this helpful? Mm-hmm. Questions? Art.
You just said about including both polarities. And if, when you know you're in a reactive pattern, allows you to open up to the spectrum of choices.
Right.
If I find myself in a situation and I only see two extreme options, is that a good indication that I'm in a reactive pattern that I don't know about?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty good indication.
Okay.
When you only see one option, that's a pretty good indication. If you see two options, yeah, you know, I can do this or that. Well, there's going to be a feeling associated with this one, right?
Yes.
There's going to be a different feeling associated with that one.
Yes.
Include both those feelings. You know. And the rest of you will go, no, no, we don't want to do that, because if I include both those feelings, there's going to be a whole bunch of other feelings I don't want to even touch. Be just like that. You've experienced that.
Yeah, I've read about it.
No, you
yeah.
I remember exchange of
that.
We're
all that. Yeah.
That. Yes.
All that.
Good thing you were 50 miles away. Other questions?
Just to clarify on the last thing, you're saying that when you only see one option, you're trying to work it backwards? Is that what you're doing? What if that one option is a product of a narrow mind?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, sometimes, say, this situation developed, and this is the only thing I can do. And the indication that it's a reactive pattern is the presence of rigidity, stickiness, unwillingness to explore. The fourth one would be urgency.
But as soon as you're willing to explore, haven't you opened up more options?
I said unwillingness to explore. That's indicative.
Sorry.
Yeah.
He's not down on what else.
No, but that's what it was.
Sometimes where
you
said rigidity, unwillingness to explore, urgency.
Stickiness.
What does that mean?
Stickiness? It's not clean.
If we apply this to what Franca is remembering from another retreat, then the person in the story who only felt there was one option, and that was to keep the
arrow, where we shot
the arrow.
But that was from the Iliad. Mm-hmm. It's a translation of Homer.
But yeah. She's asking about how do you know?
Well, opinions differ on this. I can only speak from my own experience. My own experience is I don't know. And there have been a number of situations where I thought I was completely present, active, and I found out it wasn't quite so. Big mess. And then, just as Eugene pointed out, I had that situation. And some of these were quite serious messes. And I thought I had considered all the options. I thought I had asked the right questions. I thought I had brought in the right people to advise, etc., etc. And a one, as soon as it blew up in my face, I went, "You never asked that person." That person was one of my advisors that time. And I hadn't seen it before. Because when we're in the thrall of a reactive pattern, we can only see what the pattern presents to us. And that's what Frank is referring to. It's from the Trojan War, where after a few years, the Greeks and the Trojans have decided, no, this war is pointless. Let's just agree to disagree and we can all go home and start farming again. And the gods up in the heavens, up at Mount Olympus, you know, Pallas Athene in particular, saying, "They're quitting already. I want them to fight for years. This doesn't work for me." So she invests her spirit in Piraeus or somebody, or Peleus, I can't, something like that, who's a Greek archer, who is watching the Greek and the Trojan leaders sign the agreement that will end this phase of the war, says, "This is wrong. I've got to stop this." And he pulls his, and the translation is, he pulled his bow, the arrow, bowstring back, and it just felt so right. And he shoots the arrow, and it kills one of the Trojan leaders, and there's another 10 years of Trojan War. And we have that feeling. It just feels so right. When you're really present, maybe my experience is changing here. You may be clear about the course of action, but there's also an openness that accompanies that.
That you don't control.
Yeah.
There's another correlation, interesting correlation. You talked about freedom being no choice. But also in the group of pattern, it looks like there's only one thing to do. There's no choice. I had no choice. I mean, I've heard people say that after they gave me the complete mess of things, and then they just said, "Well, I had no choice. I had to, whatever it is." So there's another weird correlation,
yes,
between those,
yeah,
two things too.
Yeah. It's a very, very different feeling. Because one feels very constricted, and the other feels very open.
So this is a way of coming to a point of action, not necessarily right for someone.
Pardon?
This is a way of coming to a point of action which may or may not be right, but it's a way of taking in as,
yeah,
much of the situation as
that,
you...
That's right, yeah.
It's interesting because there's a sense that it is free of expectation on both sides.
That's actually a very good point, because when you're acting out of the reactive pattern, there is a big expectation. When you're acting out of direct presence or so much, this is what has to happen, but there isn't any expectation. So there is a difference. That's a very good point. But you're quite right, Eugene, that this is a way of acting, and because of the necessary limitations in our perception, may not always be exactly the right thing, but it's a way of proceeding so that you are bringing full attention to what you do. Yeah, Carol?
Maybe, you know that, but it's been helpful to me. When I first heard you saying this a long time ago, I thought it was cataclysmic. It was
the end of the world.
The okay corral over and over and over again. But it's what we do in conversation. When I figured that out, it was like, oh, I'm learning every moment I'm engaged. engaged with someone or something.
Yeah.
It's not the okay corral from morning till night.
No, it isn't.
Actually, when I said that bit about expectation, I meant it in a different way.
Yes.
There's this assumption that if we act in presence,
uh-huh.
things will turn out okay, or the way we want them to.
Yeah.
And the examples you're providing is that that's not necessarily so. It's not in accord with our expectation. It's more in accord with how things are.
That's right, yeah.
And it is like a conversation. It's just to open.
Yeah. That's a good point. Thank you. Okay. We should close here. Yeah, we can stop recording. I think we'll do this now, don't you? Okay. Before dinner.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.